Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Kaiser and Ghazala Khan in the news, the parents of Humayun Khan, the Muslim American soldier killed in Iraq, and all the responses that they received to their appearance at the Democratic Convention, obviously Donald Trump's and others as well. It's kind of sparked a new interest in Gold Star parents, Gold Star families. A lot of people never even heard the term before, even if they respected the families of Americans who have died in battle. Well, it just so happens that our next guest, Mickey McElyea, a professor of history at the University of Connecticut, has a new book called The Politics of Mourning, Death and Honor in Arlington National Cemetery. And she joins us now. Professor McElyea, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks.
Why'd you write a book about the politics of Arlington National Cemetery?
I think one of the things that became really clear in the Khan family, in responses to the Khan family's appearance at the DNC and Trump's response to them, was that people sort of assume the space of Arlington and assume the military cemetery to be a self-evident location of honor and inclusion, that this was an argument for American belonging, citizenship, and the American promise, right, a representation of diversity, and that it was self-evident, that it was clear to people. That actually is a fairly recent facet of Arlington's history, and that kind of celebration of diversity, the kind of celebration of diversity that also comes in some ways with the move to an all-volunteer armed forces. Mm-hmm. That's all very much a part of our more recent history. And the longer history of the space goes back to the Civil War and the history of slavery.
And so one of the arguments you make is that Arlington's memorials symbolize a narrative of American victimization, also Islamic aggression, but also triumphant U.S. nationalism and military virtue. Do you go that far down those roads? Because one of the, those aren't always positive traits.
Right. One of the things that I think is really interesting in the context of the post 9/11 moment, which is what that argument is about, and the memorialization and acknowledging of the victims at the Pentagon in particular, and the memorial there for them, is that this representation of strength through vulnerability, innocence maintained despite aggression, is a central facet of the kind of nationalistic representations that Arlington was put to in the aftermath of 9/11. And so that space itself doesn't generate those things, but that the politics of the space and the use of the space do, which are in constant tension than with the honor and the sacrifices represented in that place.
Was that the first time some of the 9/11 victims, that civilians as well as soldiers were buried at Arlington?
No, and that's one of the fascinating aspects of the cemetery and one of the reasons why it became just ever more interesting to me as a location, because it really is a microcosm of American history and culture and population and diversity, both military and non-military, since the Civil War. The first civilians buried there were formerly enslaved people and the people who owned the plantation that it was before it was a cemetery.
Huh. And that's controversial too, right?
Absolutely.
People still talk about that, I think, on the tour when they give a tour of Arlington.
Oh, absolutely. So one of the main stops on the tour bus through Arlington is Arlington House, which is today the Robert E. Lee National Memorial. Robert E. Lee was in resident and his wife, the life tenure owner of Arlington Plantation, before it was occupied in the Civil War. The plantation was built by enslaved people for George Washington Parke Custis, who was George Washington's adopted grandson.
You key in the book on a particular speech that Donald Rumsfeld, who was defense secretary under George W. Bush, a speech he gave, right?
Absolutely. So Rumsfeld used Arlington and also used the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier and the concept of the unknown and used that site to really, in some ways, change the meaning of who constitutes a soldier, who constitutes a potential warrior in what he was framing as a war against Islamic aggression. As he was doing that, and as he was honoring the people who died at the Pentagon and incorporating civilians into that narrative as unknowns, there were five sets of remains that were unidentifiable from the Pentagon attack, and those included the remains of a child. They included the remains of civilians, and he marked them as unknowns in an ongoing war, like earlier unknowns. He likened a child who had died in that attack as an unknown soldier, as
and
a service
personnel.
Do you have
a problem with that?
I think it's yes. It is a loose it's a loose definition and a loose use of that idea that does a disservice both to the sacrifices and long history of military service, and then also it narrows the scope of our ability to sort of see the complexities in each of these events and see the complexities in our foreign policy and various aspects of our contemporary military engagement around the world. And it also embraces and promotes a culture of fear.
Listeners, any questions for Mickey McAleer, University of Connecticut history professor, author of a new book called The Politics of Mourning, Death and Honor in Arlington National Cemetery, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Watching a video of the speech made by Rumsfeld at Arlington in 2002, you could become aware of how specifically Christian the ceremony seems, considering it was for 184 civilians and soldiers who died who were diverse. Is this the norm with mass military burials, or was this strategic rhetoric in a way to frame the war on terror?
It was strategic rhetoric in many ways, but it also draws on a long history of a predominantly Judeo-Christian understanding of who constitutes an American and what constitutes sort of American public space and representation. But that's something that has been a central facet both of the armed forces and of the cemetery itself as different forms and a different sort of a widening embrace of diversity over time. But one of the things that I think is critical to remember in this context and that the cemetery makes so clear is that narrative of expansive belonging and a broadening of the vision of who constitutes an American has always been paired with a sense of exclusion and an argument about who doesn't belong.
You write about ways that gender and notions of maternal care come into play at Arlington. Can you give us an example?
Yeah, generally, so you have this sense that the military service personnel is a young male who fights and sacrifices himself for the nation, and he is mourned by a series of women, predominantly his mother, that the mourning mother has been a key figure not only in U.S. history and at Arlington National Cemetery, but this is a longstanding gender dynamic of memory and mourning and who's responsible for maintaining that that care and that memory. And so you see that very clearly in the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, which immediately sparks Mother's Day events for the mothers of lost military service personnel. And you see that very consistently, I think, also in responses to Mrs. Khan and in the way that people understood her place both at the DNC, but then longer histories of the Khan's public engagement with the site and as Gold Star parents.
Are there differences in the designs of the gravestones at all at Arlington? We think of one mass of perfectly identical stones, which is different in a national cemetery than it is in a regular cemetery, where you might have different sizes, different shapes, different designs, et cetera. There's a uniformity to this.
Absolutely. So much of the cemetery is filled with, although that is also officers can have distinctive tombstones. So People who go to Arlington National Cemetery might be surprised to see an array of stones. But you're exactly right in that when we imagine the vision of a military cemetery, we imagine that uniformity. And some of the profound and utterly beautiful and also utterly sort of horrific representation of loss is just to see that sea of uniform headstones. The things that are distinctive, other than marking names and place of service and rank, is that the top of each uniform military headstone is a representation of belief, a faith or belief, and also a representation now of non-belief. Mm. You can have a representation of atheism. Over the years, that has expanded to include a variety of emblems. And in the context of looking to the cemetery, particularly looking to the cemetery to talk about Islam and to talk about American citizenship and belonging, people have pointed to the crescent and the star on top of that headstone to say this is about the dynamic diversity and embrace of American culture. But one of the things that relies upon, particularly when it's the optics of just looking at that visual, and we've seen Captain Khan's headstone so many times now since the DNC, that it presumes our surprise. It presumes that you don't expect to see it there. Right. So part of that dynamic is still that element of work and exclusion and disconnect between those things.
Do you make any policy recommendations in this book? Is there something that you would like to see the government affirmatively decide to do differently with respect to Arlington?
There are a number of things I would like to see. And one of the critical aspects of the cemetery, particularly since Kennedy's burial there and the surge in popularity of the cemetery as a site for interments, is that it's a small piece of ground, and it's hemmed in by highway system. It's hemmed in by everything that surrounds Washington, D.C. and funnels people into D.C. There is a time where it will not be able to absorb more internments and interments. And there is a struggle, and there is something that the military and the federal government need to confront, sort of how to deal with the eventuality that there won't be space for expansion, although we have a recent expansion again.
We have that here in New York, too. I happen to have relatives on my wife's side of the family buried in the Cypress Hills National Cemetery, which is – it spans the Brooklyn-Queens border, and I think is the second biggest in the country in next to Arlington.
Arlington is not the largest by any stretch in the country, which is another piece of the story.
But Cypress Hills is pretty much out of space as well. So do you think that the U.S. needs to establish more national cemeteries?
Yes, and that is one of the things that's actually happened, that there is an expansion underway now that was celebrated over the summer as being the largest expansion of the national cemetery system since the Civil War, which produced the national cemetery system in the United States. And the goal for many has long been to have a cemetery in every state and territory of the U.S., and it becomes closer to reaching that goal.
Fascinating. What do you hope will come of your book?
I hope that there will be greater discussion about the complexity of Arlington National Cemetery as a site, that there will be more discussion of the cemetery also as not only a memorial, as a memorial and a memorial place for thinking about sacrifice and honor of service personnel, but also as a monument to slavery, which is what it simultaneously is. And the other piece that I would like
to see. And the area was actually a refuge for freed slaves before they took it for a national cemetery.
Absolutely.
Right?
A year before the cemetery is established there, it becomes a site for what was called Freedmen's Village and a contraband camp. The idea that formerly enslaved people who were freeing themselves in the context of war were contraband of war to be dealt with. It was a way for the military to help get people out of Washington, D.C., but it was also a planned community that was designed to teach formerly enslaved people in the ways of becoming free laborers and industriousness as it was envisioned by reformers and the federal government. It's a site of significant conflict over what freedom was going to look like.
Fascinating. We have one call that's come in from a former military guy, so let's take it. Dave in Port Jervis, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, I'm interested in would they consider a mausoleum. I know it sounds kind of crazy, you know, to have like a warehouse type of deal, but, you know, would a mausoleum
You mean
mausoleum
for, space for space considerations? Is that why you
yes.
ask?
Yeah.
Absolutely. And there is a large columbarium that's inside the cemetery now, and that is expanding. There's also some plans underway for adding other spaces for interments rather than in-ground burials as a way to facilitate expanding that space. One of the things that has resulted in certain instances is a real value, a differently valued aspect where an in-ground burial now comes to mean more to some people than an interment because the rules for those are different. But that certainly was one of the key solutions starting in 1980.
Mickey McAleer, University of Connecticut history professor, is now the author of The Politics of Mourning, Death and Honor in Arlington National Cemetery. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.